This is a good way to start the show, actually. James Portney says, I was thinking about getting a Motorola. Would you?
Fun story. Last night, while we were waiting for the Motorola news to drop, because there was no live stream and there was no timing whatsoever, I thought about getting one. I honestly thought about getting one. And, like, not telling anybody. Just, like, for my own futuristic technology whims, just to get one.
I don't get why everyone's not talking about how it's going to have the worst battery life of every of any Pixel, I mean Motorola phone, ever made.
Because
I'm not sure if you caught the joke there.
Yeah, I did. The delusion with this phone is that you're using a small screen and that you're not really using the phone as much as you're using the tiny 2.7 inch 800 by 600 quick view screen on the front of the phone when it's closed.
So the idea is using that screen sometimes is supposed to help your battery life. Has Motorola said anything about the whole battery life situation?
All day is the official guidance, which is what everybody says. And it's meaningless. Yeah. 2510 milliamp hours. So.
Also, where is the battery like physically in that device? It's really thin. Is the battery all crammed in the bottom chin?
Two batteries, actually. It's a standard sized square, but I believe the FCC teardown the day before revealed that there's two, actually.
One on each top half.
Yeah.
Nice. They must be pretty thin batteries then. I'm just overall really impressed with this from an engineering standpoint, because it seems like they accomplished what Samsung accomplished, at least.
Yes.
You know,
which,
like,
it's surprising.
Yeah, because it felt like, I mean, Samsung has way more resources and way more, you know, muscle behind that.
They have a full Samsung Displays. It's full division. It's its own company.
And not to mention just how much more money Samsung has to put behind it. And well, Motorola, it seems like, has accomplished. Motorola and Lenovo are the same, which is, I forget that sometimes.
As we do. As all we do.
Well, it's getting harder and harder to forget as things devolve.
Yes, devolve greatly.
What do you think about the, like, I don't know, just the foldable design and as a whole? We saw the Galaxy Fold do, you know, I guess this is kind of the age old elementary school, is it a hamburger or a hot dog kind of, you know, folding paper in, like, you know, second grade. Everyone fold it hot dog style. And this is the Galaxy Fold was a hot dog style. And this is the hamburger fold. And I don't know. I mean, it is. In the imperfect metaphor, it is.
Fair.
What do you think about? Do you think this is a more practical design in general? And
for me, I'm really enamored with that small screen. I like really small tiny devices, and the idea of using a tiny screen to get just the priority information, just notifications, just the quick messaging and quick replying to people. I think that,
and for some people, quick selfies.
It's alluring, it's tempting, to the idea that you're just using a mini phone and you can do everything you need with that small screen. Which, I don't know, that there might be something there. That form factor has never really been tried at scale. Well, not that this Motorola Razr is going to do it, but the Palm phone didn't do it either. So,
yeah,
there might be something there.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the big sticking point for me, and I think for pretty much anyone, is going to be the $1,500 price tag. Like, that's... And I'm probably years away from using a phone like this as my actual daily driver. Although Motorola has surprised me before, you know, the Moto Z, the small, tiny, thin Moto Z, as you've said many times as well. It is surprisingly, I mean, I found myself surprised that I actually chose to use that device as my daily driver just because I really enjoyed how thin it was. But anyways, I just think I'm probably a few years away from being able to use a device like this as my daily driver just because it's too limited in terms of, you know, I need a robust device in terms of things like battery life and performance and stuff like this. And that this exact device is going to have pretty awful battery life probably. And it's probably going to, you know, it's kind of mid-range Snapdragon processor and, you know, and various other things that are probably holding it back. Not to mention it only has one camera and, you know, other compromises. And so I don't think I can accept any of these compromises probably for at least a couple of years, as my daily driver phone, but as just someone who's into cool technology, the $1,500 price tag is what's keeping me from
yeah,
caring. I mean, I literally am just putting it out of my head because I can't, there's no, like, I'm not going to spend, I just spent $2,400 on a MacBook. There's no way I'm spending $1,500 on a cool little, cool gadget. It's a cool novelty, gadget.
Though. It's a cool gadget, but it's novelty. And
it's very clearly a novelty phone. And yeah, so for me, it's a little bit,
yeah, it's like a second phone.
Yeah, if I were to buy it, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's again, like you said at the top of the show, it's surprising that Motorola did this in terms of the technological capability and compared to like Samsung and Huawei, what they're doing. So,
right.
Props to them. And the thing that they really did well is that how the screen has no crease. They have a very clever folding mechanism and all that. So,
yeah.
One, there's no crease. Two, when it's open, it's completely flat. It rays completely flat.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, even though I pretty much I'm ignoring this phone, besides having to cover it for my job, it's not going to mean anything to me. And I don't think it's going to mean anything to 99% of people there. I think that this is just going to be a cool novelty phone that, you know, very small percentage of people pick up that are just avid Razer fanatics. But I don't know, like what it is doing for me though, is it's making me consider more seriously. So the Galaxy Fold, we've talked about the foldable devices 10 times on the show, and it's been interesting for me to see my opinions and my feelings about them evolve over time. And at first, you know, I don't know if you remember, but at first I was just like, this is silly. And it's starting with this device and seeing people use it, seeing people go hands-on with it, I feel like it's starting to get a little bit more interesting, compelling to me. This device feels more practical.
In terms of form factor.
I'm starting to see a little bit of the appeal of saving, you know, it's the volume of the phone is the same in your pocket, but the surface area is smaller. And I'm starting to see how being able to have the same device, the same screen size in a form factor that's half the area could be a compelling thing, not to mention a satisfying thing. You know, a lot of reasons people are talking about this phone at all is because you can, you know, slam the phone closed when you hang up a phone call and, you know, flick it out really, you know, satisfyingly and stuff like that. So, yeah, I don't know. It's just interesting. I don't think that I would buy a phone like this until we get to the point where Google or Apple are doing one. Or Samsung does one better, which they will. They will. And I'm interested in that. I'm interested to see the second. We've seen teased the second Galaxy Foldable, the Galaxy Fold Hamburger. And it looks interesting to me. And I'm excited to see what happens. But anyways.
Yeah. In terms of...
What's up?
In terms of software, like I would rather buy a foldable phone for Motorola. They do a pretty good job of keeping a stock experience. That said, when this launches in early January, it's running Android 9 Pi.
Yeah.
Android 9 Pi.
Yeah. Major fall from grace.
$1,500 phone.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. $1,500 phone, and whatever, most people won't care, but
yeah,
you know, it's sad that this is where Motorola has landed. I was joking that we need to clone Rick and put Rick back. we need another Rick on Motorola. So anyways, let's talk a little bit about some other things that happened this week. I guess staying on the track of phones, we can talk about RCS, which is Rich Communication Services. And we've been talking about this a long time on the show, but this week, and specifically today, some really big things happened. And we haven't really had a show in a couple of weeks, so other big-ish things have happened since we talked last, I think. I don't know if we mentioned on the last show that basically someone found out how to enable Google's server-based RCS on any device with Android Messages installed. And I'm pretty sure our article about that hit like 500,000 page views. And so let's say 25% of those actually enabled it. Us alone sent a bare minimum of hundreds of thousands of people to enable this. And so it ended up being probably an unintended beta test for what apparently today turned out to be Google's intended launch of its own RCS services for Android Messages, which is now rolling out to every Android phone that has Android Messages installed.
In the US.
In the US.
Which is the market that needs it the most, really. In terms of adoption of, or rather in terms of the lack of adoption of like Facebook Messenger or WhatsApp and other third-party clients. So yeah, Google did it. They shockingly decided to just take over the RCS rollout from the carriers. Two, they are beating this CCMI, this cross-carrier messaging initiative that the big four in the US are planning for next year with its own Android app. So the relationship between the carriers and Google, I'm very curious how that's playing out. Because the CCMI seems to be dead on arrival at this point. Yes, the carriers probably want to force all new phones, all new Android phones to pre-roll that app. But I think most people, even if it's just by word of mouth, will be pushed to Google's app eventually. And in that year-long run-up to the competitor actually running.
Yeah, I don't know how this is all going to play out. I guess I'm just overall pessimistic about every aspect of it. people have been emailing me telling me I'm too pessimistic about everything, but I'm trying to be realistic about the outlook. But anyways, like I think with the RCS thing, what's interesting to me is seeing how the public facing kind of PR, and this is maybe something that only journalists really care or would even notice, but kind of the public facing messaging around RCS has been really, and messaging, no pun intended, has been really, really interesting to see. I mean, anyone that hasn't been following, Google kind of did a really big PR push. Was it a year and a half ago now or something like that? Maybe going on 2 years. I don't know. But it's been a long time. But Google did a really big PR push via Dieter at The Verge on RCS right around the time that they were shutting down Allo, and or maybe it was before they shut down Allo, before, you know, we reported on Hangouts' eventual death. And basically said that the future of Google messaging, they were trying to paint a picture of kind of the future of what Google intends to do with messaging. And the picture they painted was simple. Our RCS is that's what we're doing, which has its holes and caveats and disadvantages, such as no end-to-end encryption, among others. But at the time, it seemed like Google was the one leading up the initiative. From a PR standpoint, it seemed like Google was the one leading the charge on RCS, and they've got their whole Jibe initiative, which is connected to RCS kind of. And they were saying, we've got all the carriers on board. We've got, you know, this organization, this one, we've got Samsung on board. I don't know if you remember, but they listed, you know, a dozen partners that they said they were working with. And it seemed like Google was kind of the center point of this whole, worldwide RCS rollout. And then it just didn't happen.
No.
I mean, 12 months, 18 months went by. I don't know the exact timeline, but a long time went by. And we saw Verizon, you know, enable RCS for the Pixel 3 running on Verizon servers. And we saw, you know, we saw Sprint do some things. We saw T-Mobile do some things with some phones. So some phones on some carriers got some RCS. Some of them got the universal profile, which is basically, for those that don't know, the RCS that we're talking about. And then some other phones got you know, a closed version of RCS, which is, you know, only capable or only interoperable between certain phones on certain carriers. And it's all been a confusing big mess. But the long story, the skinny of it is that Google took the initiative on this, at least tried to pitch it that way. And it just didn't happen. And the carriers never did anything. And then that leads up to the most recent part of the story, which is Google decided in certain countries in Europe to just decide, they just decided to just turn it on themselves and put it on their own servers. Which interestingly, in some of those carriers have since then actually adopted their own, you know, or moved RCS support over to their own, carrier based server. So, and then, so the CCMI is the latest development or one of the more recent developments and that's this, you know, it's the carriers have come out and saying, so Google tried to take the charge and that all failed from our perspective. And then now the carriers have said, yeah, we know we didn't do anything, but now we're going to do something. And the carriers are banding together. And in that PR push and that messaging, there was no mention of Google, which is gotta feel like a slap in the face to Google, which has put so much resources and effort and money behind getting this thing happening. And basically the carriers said they were doing their own app. They said they're going to band together and get this launched, get this pushed through, at least in the United States. And then the most recent development in the story is that Google has decided to just turn everything on for the US, for all US users in Android messages. Now, the question is, all this said, that's the very short 5-minute version of this whole story, unless am I missing any major details there? That's the 5-minute version. And the question is this what Google is rolling out today? Is this the panacea? Is this the end of the story, Abner? Is it all over now? Can Google declare victory and just let the carriers do what they want to do now? Or are there caveats here?
I'm of two minds, and to determine more, I'm curious how Google is going to push this. If Google advertises it, that's the real FU to carriers. If they advertise that the Messages app, this Google-based Messages app and service, is how Android users in the US should communicate, that means that this is a real concerted effort by the company. If they're very quiet about it, I think that clearly paints how they don't want to rile up the four big carriers, their four big partners, and I think regulators too, to some degree. But with that taken into consideration, I think what Google did today has a chance of being successful, if only in a word of mouth kind of way, Android users telling other Android users to upgrade their phones, to upgrade to RCS in the Messages app, to download the Messages app in the first place. I think there's a chance, I don't even want to put percentage on it, but I think there's a chance it's become successful, but it's going to be a quiet, long effort that just happened in the background.
Yeah, I think there are a few things to talk about here. One big question that people are asking is, why hasn't Google done this the whole time? And the answer is, I think, really, really complicated. I think a lot of people I've seen a lot of takes that are saying Google should have done this 4 years ago. And I think the danger that Google was kind of facing earlier on in the RCS story, and maybe I'm wrong, this is all my own, I'm trying to do my best of analyzing the situation. I'm not an expert in this category, so disclaimer, I may be saying things that are completely untrue. But from my perspective, it seems like the risk that Google was taking, if they had done this earlier than now, was this ending up being a Google initiative. Google did not want to be the center point of RCS, because what Google, so the end point of what Google hopes to accomplish is that all Android phones can communicate with each other using a universal standard. And that would span all the makers, that would span all the OEMs. And unfortunately, Google only has, and has traditionally with Android, only had so much control over what those Android OEMs can do. For a variety of reasons, including antitrust stuff and, you know, monopoly controversies and stuff like that. But I think there's a reason that it was never as easy as Google just Google just needs to do iMessage, because Google and Google's partners, OEM partners on with Android have their own interests. They have their own self-interest. And that's where the Android ecosystem, let's say in the US, 50% of phones are Android phones, 50% of phones are iPhones. You know, if that's the case, like with the iPhone, Apple controls everything. So they can just roll out this to every single phone. Android, Google doesn't have that same, never had that same control over Android phones. And so Google can't just tell Samsung, hey, you have to install this messaging app by default. And I think the risk all along was that if Google just jumped the gun on this whole RCS thing, then it would be viewed as just another messaging attempt on Google's part. It would be seen that way by regulators. It would be seen that way by their competitors, who are also their partners. And there would have been a lot of reluctance, and there would have been a lot of probably pushback from the carriers too, because none of this, since things were so early in development and rollout and everything else for the longest time, I don't think it was ever a given. I mean, even with all of the effort that's been put into it pushing RCS, it still hasn't happened over the last few years. I don't think that RCS replacing SMS was really a given for a really long time. And I think it's finally gotten to a place where it's a given. The carriers had to come out and say they were taking the initiative. They're going to do this regardless. And now Google felt, okay, we can pull the trigger on this. We can light up the servers. Because we can do so without it seeming like we're just launching a messaging service, because regardless of what we do, the carriers have already said they're going to do it. And I think that's kind of the answer, the short answer to why Google couldn't have done this 4 years ago, because they needed to wait until a perfect moment in the story, I think, to where they could pull the trigger without it affecting any of the relationships. There's still a lot of parts of this, moving pieces, that we still don't know. I mean, even today, one of the big caveats with today's announcement is Samsung phones, which, for those that don't know, are a huge percentage of Android phones. Like, what's the percentage in the US of Android phones? Like, it's got to be the majority. Those phones are not going to get RCS anytime soon, because those phones don't pack Android messages as the default messaging client. They have Google or Samsung's own SMS texting app, and those people can go out of their way to download Google's and get RCS via that, but the majority of Samsung users are going to be completely oblivious to this. So yeah, I mean, what do you feel like that's, I mean, does that seem like a sensible, at least partial explanation to kind of the how and why that all this has rolled out? What do you think?
Yeah, it's all optics. It's optics that Google kind of brought on itself by not having a cohesive messaging solution for so many years and for having so many fail. That's the optics of that. And then there's the optics of Google's power and reach. And again, the regulator thing, which is, I think, being an under-discussed element.
I think another element of this that's not talked about is that ultimately Google wants Apple to do RCS. Right? Like,
yeah.
Like, ultimately, it would benefit Google so much. It would be a big deal if Apple added RCS to its own messages app. And if RCS the whole time was clearly a Google-centric effort and not a carrier-centric effort, then Apple would have had much more reason to push back and make sure that that never happened. And
they've said that they do it, not that Apple has even announced.
Even as things stand, even as things stand, it's definitely a question mark. So, I mean, yeah. It was never really a question of whether Google could launch a phone number connected messaging app. That's like that was never in the question. That was never in the card. That was whether they Google did. Could do that. They did. It was called Hangouts. And, you know, or at least Hangouts had SMS fallback, and, you know, they've got Google Voice. The answer is, like, they that was never part of the
Allo.
Concern.
Yeah.
And Allo, yes. And so really the concern was, how can Google do it in a way that will actually pan out for them? Because clearly,
so now, yeah,
clearly the kind of the separate messaging application hopes and strategies never panned out. And, you know, well, the exception of Hangouts to some degree, even that never reached the widespread acclaim and success of, you know, competitors like WhatsApp or the
okay,
like.
Okay, so
how about RCS? Now? How about now?
Yes.
The answer is, it seems like them pulling the trigger today. Is Google going to push this? It seems like
going to advertise this.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think this is going to be in the background, and I think that this is just going to be a real. It's going to be. So this is what the question you have to ask is: how is this going to seem to customers? Customers are not going to know any of what we're talking about. They're not going to know that the RCS is being hosted on Google servers or on the carrier servers. To them, it doesn't matter. I think the answer for consumers is that various phones at various times over the next year are going to be getting RCS. And I think that this move by Google is simply Google trying to put a little bit of gasoline on the fire. And it truly, that's what it is. It is not a cure-all for Google's messaging situation. It's not. But it may be a little bit of a putting fuel on the fire to push our, now that the carriers have independently decided and confirmed and seem to have put a little bit of intentionality behind their plans for RCS. It seems now Google can do this, and ultimately it will be in the carrier's best interest if they're going to do RCS, which at this point seems certain. If they're going to do it, I think it's in their best interest to decentralize it as quick as possible. I think that's the position that Google's in now, is that it will be in, like, the carriers will want control over this. And I think Google is like, great, do it. We dare you, you know, like, go ahead, take it. We're absolutely glad for you to do that, because if the carriers really take this full bore, then, you know, the chances that it will become universal are substantially greater, quicker, and the chances that Apple eventually adopts it is equally higher. So that's RCS. It's a confusing mess. I mean, we know, but, you know, that's our best attempt to unpack it. In the meantime, if you're a Pixel user, today is really good news, because today means that so if you're a Pixel user or a user of any Android phone that has Messages installed by default, over the coming days you will have our RCS via this rollout. And so whereas yesterday, you know, there was very limited number of Pixel phones even that had the ability to communicate with the RCS, unless you use the RCS test server trick. The number of Android phones, we can't lie, that have RCS is going to substantially increase over the next week. So yeah, keep an eye out for that. Yeah, that's that. What else happened this week, Abner?
Google Cache is, before we talk about Stadia, I think this deserves a minute. Google is looking into partnering with Citibank and this smaller credit union to offer checking accounts to, I guess that the best way to think of this is as a way to modernize checking accounts for, I don't know, I'm sure assistant will be involved or whatever. Just basically putting a clean, modern front in front of checking accounts. And this will obviously be seen in the context of the Apple card, but I think
and
it's
every other
on
card.
The same level. Yeah, Square is doing one.
Robinhood, it's like every tech company is trying to enter banking.
I don't think this is it'll be too splashy. I guess everybody's going to be hesitant because of Google Wallet card. There's actually a precedent here of Google trying this and going away from it. But this, at the very least,
not
this time, not the same thing. But at the very least, this time it'll last longer.
Yeah, I mean, everything Google does, every initiative Google takes now is kind of shadowed by the Google kills everything narrative. There was a story that came out this week, if we want to immediately pivot to Stadia, that one of the biggest concerns that developers are having is that, you know, I guess we will just go Stadia. 12 games. Let's start there. 12 games. That's where Stadia's starting off. And that's really unfortunate. I mean, it's fine. I mean, they got to start somewhere. And they've got to prove the model before they can really get all these studios on board, really investing in it. But that's, I mean, is that not a little bit sad?
It's a little bit sad. From the general public, Google has been working on it. It looks like Google's been working on this for a very long time, that they announced it 8 months ago, and this is the work they have to show for it, 12 games. But from the insider's perspective, it's a very big technical challenge, and Google was entering an entire new industry. But again, what matters at the end is what regular people think, what people willing to spend $129 things. And 12 games is not impressive, even if you get one of them for free. It's really, it is a beta, which given like the splashiness around this, how Google has been having direct to consumer live streams and all that, it seems like a finished product, but the actuality of it in terms of what features will be available day one, it's clearly a beta until next year when they launch the free tier, which is what Google as a company excels at, offering free stuff.
Are you excited for it? I honestly, you're gonna try it out, right?
Yes.
What is there any aspect of this? I'm just curious. Like, I'm trying to find the silver lining in this whole story.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm always fascinated with everything Google does, mostly from a technological standpoint, because usually, like, Google is on the forefront of these innovations so often, and this seems like yet another case. And so I'm interested in it, and I'm optimistic about it from that perspective. But I guess for you, as someone who's actually, I just don't have time to play games. I have an Xbox and 15 games in the drawer, and I just don't play them ever. And that's not to say I'm so busy and very important. It's just I just don't play games much. It's just the reality. But you will. So what do you, I guess, as a consumer, as a buyer, you bought the Founders Edition, yes?
Yes.
What are you looking forward to, I guess?
It's okay. I have to admit, it's mostly the technological aspect of this, of Stadia as a very brand new thing that Google is doing, that this is something very new for the company, a very new service, could be a very big part of Google's future, this streaming technology. And on that front, this is utterly exciting. It's huge, the scale, the potential of how successful this could be. It's something to be very interested in. But on that closer day-to-day game front, so to me right now, gaming is there's still a hassle to setting up the Xbox, which is the console I have, and playing games and updating every so often before I can play even. That's all pain. That's all an annoyance. And I'm in the same boat as you, as in not having a lot of time to game versus other things. But I think the lower barrier to starting could be a huge encouragement for me to spending that hour of free time I have here and there or less to spend it gaming. And I think that is where Google wants to go. The tagline is gaming for everyone, bringing games to everyone, rather. And the people very, very interested in Stadia right now are these professional gamers. They're used to AAA titles. They're used to gaming professionally. But I think the real potential here is for everybody else, which is not really the best footing that Google is doing at launch. Like, this launch is mostly the people most interested in the launch are professional gamers, not the average person. And there's a real disconnect there. But I think that, like, every Google product is a promise that it gets better in the future. And Stadia is absolutely the same.
Yeah, to me, I don't know. It feels like AAA titles, and this is all coming from someone who doesn't game. So I don't know all the details. I'm sure someone could yell at me and tell me I'm wrong, but it just seems like to me that a lot of like the AAA gaming experience has felt kind of stuck in the past. And that to me, at the Stadia keynote at GDC earlier this year, the most exciting aspect of all this to me was, the whole just like being able to click play anywhere, stream to YouTube with one click, watch someone else streaming and, click a button and suddenly you're streaming or you're playing the game yourself on your own, Stadia instance or whatever. Like that, like just making access to AAA titles really, really lightweight and low effort. It goes beyond just online game AAA game streaming has been a proven possibility for a decade now. On live, a long time ago proved that it was possible. And these other competing services are now, Xbox's service and others are also, they're going to be doing the same thing. So I just don't think that from a technological standpoint that what Google's doing is super special. To me, what's really, special and interesting about it is how, is the interconnectedness with the web and like all these, especially YouTube. That was just the one thing that really stuck out to me was, just being able to build a community around these games that's not restricted to your friends list on Xbox Live. Being able to quickly share videos and replays on social media, with one tap, which is, I know these are all, some of these things are features that have been, possible on consoles for a while, but I just think that it felt like a little bit to me, it kind of felt like, because they were moving everything to the cloud and making everything so lightweight, it kind of felt like the difference between, watching them, like this is kind of how it seems to me, is like the difference between popping a DVD to watch a movie versus, pulling up a movie, renting a movie on YouTube for $1.99 and then casting it with a Chromecast. Like it felt like Stadia is, or Chromecast is to movies as Stadia is to games. Like that's kind of how it felt to me. Maybe that's not a perfect, metaphor, but I don't know. It's just that, just the ease of access and just taking down all the barriers to entry, like you said, is just so interesting to me. And unfortunately, though, I think what we have to talk about is kind of the news that came out in the AMA this week. It seems like for the last few weeks, the story has been that restriction upon restriction upon restriction upon disappointment has been happening going up to the launch, where it's seeming like the vision that Google painted back at GDC is not exactly what we're going to have on day one by any stretch of the imagination. And maybe you can talk about some of the ways that we're seeing that.
Yeah, so like the Stadia controller is the only piece of new hardware that Google's making for Stadia. And the big appeal, the big push was that it connects directly over Wi-Fi to the Stadia instance. It provides the most latency-free experience possible. But it only works at launch with your Chromecast on your TV. If you want to play on desktop or your phone, which is something that most people want to do, it's the most futuristic aspect. I had a chance to try Xbox Project Cloud, and really playing a game on your phone, playing Halo in my case, was wild. But I digress. But to do that with Stadia, you need to use a wire. You need to connect it over USB-C. It's a minor thing, but this is like a big part of the push was this futuristic Wi-Fi controller. Right,
the freedom of it. It's like if they launched Chromecast and they said, oh, by the way, you have to plug in your phone to be able to do it. And it's like, well, the whole point was that the whole point is that this is all just going to happen over the network.
Yeah. Another thing is game achievements. Google apparently, full launch, they have The UI to show game achievements isn't ready. All games in Stadia will be recording your achievements, but there's currently no UI to display them, which is seems like a thing that professional gamers, the first users you're going to have on board would care about. Let's see. Assistant is not as quite as advanced.
That's right now.
It is right now limited to like launching apps. So like
that's it. Launch, to be very clear, that's all. Whereas the pitch at GDC was, you know, you can have assistant help you with different challenges level, you're facing in the game, or look up a video for you, or whatever.
There is
a dedicated assistant button on the controller, and it does one thing: it launches games.
Yeah, with your voice. Just
silly.
Yeah, it's like that kind of stuff.
There's also no really, you can't use wireless headphones. Right?
Yeah. Bluetooth. you have to use a 3.5 millimeter jack on the Stadia controller, which is sure. Bluetooth audio support isn't coming later until launch. It seems like
service isn't coming until later.
the promise.
So there's only 12 games. Some of the games like Destiny will be closed off from, you know, multi-platform stuff. You have to plug in a cable, the wireless controller, to use it with your phone. You have to use plugged in wired headphones.
It's only 1080p.
4K. Yeah. Also, if you already own a Chromecast Ultra for playing, you're gonna have to wait until after launch to get a firmware update before you can play.
Yeah,
even if you bought a Founders pack or whatever, the $130 pack,
you have to use the Ultra that comes in the pack.
Yes, exactly. And even then, speaking of, hasn't there been controversy around, like, it doesn't even seem like most people are going to have this hardware on launch day because shipments are going to be delayed? It's like, why didn't you just launch this next year or something? Like, what? It's like they pushed this through and literally everything is like delayed. Like there's no games with like Stream Connect, State Share, Crowdplay, multiplayer, YouTube stuff. Like pretty much everything they talked about is not happening at launch.
And I know like there are people that are going to argue that this is like the argument that this is a beta. There's an argument that this is a beta, that it seems like a beta. But if you've been on the internet and have been pushed so many Stadia ads to buy Founders Edition, to buy Premiere Edition, those ads on the internet are horrific.
Yeah, they were making this seem like a big blockbuster launch, like Disney Plus or something.
Yeah, if you're a person that does not, that's interested, this seems cool, let me buy this and play this. I don't think the experience is going to match. There's so many restrictions on day one that stop this from being a seamless, futuristic, this is the future of gaming. Maybe.
Yeah, the bigger concern, I think, and the bigger concern is that first impressions are so important. You can't shake first impressions. And this is a problem that Google has with so many of their hardware and services, and that is like, they launch something, it push it out. They have optimistic timelines. They push it out before it's done. And people can never shake the initial impressions. Allo.
Yeah.
Allo was a bare bones. It was literally nothing the day it launched. There was nothing. There was no features. It was literally just a phone number and a messaging app. That's it. And it's like when people try out a product of any kind for the first time, they're immediately judging whether or not this is a product that deserves, you know, mind space and time in their life. And it feels like everyone who bought the $130 Founders pack who tries out Stadia next week is going to be so sorely disappointed. And that's so sad. Not to mention, you got to pay up front full price for all these games.
Yeah, that's a thing.
If the service survives,
we don't know how much it's priced yet.
Yeah.
They haven't revealed any of the games. So actually, I want to go back to the point you said about how impressive is Stadia really? And I think the gist of the argument was that all these companies are eventually going to get this point where the connectivity is good enough, where the processing power is there in the cloud. is, okay, like products like Allo, in hindsight, the fact that it was missing basic features on day one is baffling. And Google in general has this philosophy of getting a minimum viable product out the door and updating it and updating it. So yeah. Is Stadia, I think Stadia deserves a little bit more credit in terms of how big the scale is, how optimistic they're trying to be. And like that covers some of the fact that not all the features are available. But if that were going to be the case, I think Google should have ramped down all this public facing advertising. Maybe they should have had another beta or whatever.
Like, or maybe they should have ramped up all the advertisement like this winter and launched it in full for consumers in like March or something, and had a closed beta and called it that and launched it next week with a closed beta. It's like, do you think that the holiday season aspect affected this really seemingly poor decision making? I don't know. I like to answer your question. Seems like the only answer. I mean, to answer your question, I feel like Stadia almost deserves less credit because you're asking people to invest so much more than, you know, it's like with Allo, you're asking people to invest 3 taps to try out your minimum viable product. For this, they're asking people to invest real money into hardware. And you can't, let's say Google shuts down Stadia in a year or two. You can't, like, this, all the hardware you bought is worthless, you know, or it's like, I don't know. It's like, and not to mention all the games you buy in the service too are going to be worthless if it ever shuts down. And it seems like whether or not it shuts down in the long run is going to be so contingent on how this first few months goes. I mean, I know the gaming community is used to kind of closed off betas before gaming services and games launch before they actually come out. Like that's been a thing traditionally for a decade where, you know, you buy Halo 3 and you get exclusive access to the Halo 4 beta for like 3 months and everyone knows that it's messed up and everyone judges it accordingly. But that's not how Google pitched this. They didn't pitch this as a closed beta that's going to be launching next week. They pitched it as,
this is the future of gaming on November 19th.
Yes.
It's
a marketing problem. It's a PR problem. It's a messaging problem.
Yeah.
And it's going to shoot them in the, they're going to be shooting themselves in the foot. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
Especially when you're asking people to buy $130 worth of hardware alongside it.
But it's so much cheaper than a console. I give that a lot more credit. Like, okay, crisp holiday season coming up. It's $130. You get this. It's $130 versus, well, an Xbox now is $200. A Switch is $250 or something. It's
consumer product with full fledged feature sets and.
Sure. Yeah, but it's like, I don't know. People like $100 things, and that is an attractive thing to most people. And that is to say, the launch should have been much better for the holiday season, and maybe it could be more feature complete when everybody opens their bundles on December 25th and the rest of the holiday season. Maybe there's something there, but I think Google really wanted to hit the holiday season.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so of course. Tuesday, November 19th at 9 a.m. It's like Google has said over and over that they're in this for the long haul. That's what they've been saying. They've invested a lot of infrastructure they would be losing a lot of money if they just shut this down in a few years versus giving it a good decade. And I think that at the end of the day, there is some solid potential for, I want to give them more credit for I'd say that they'll update with new features every single week. Mm-hmm. They'll try to get new features every single week. I think
this team they built out is like fully dedicated to Stadia and whatnot. So I think the launch next week might look a bit weird. It might not meet every single expectation that all those ads are hitting. But if they can save it in a month's time, by that holiday season. I think they have something.
Also, despite the huge marketing push, I have to say that I don't think that this has really... It doesn't seem like it's drummed up very much excitement in the game.
No, there have been no... Well, yeah, the gaming community of pro gamers, definitely.
What were you going to say,
though? The ads have all been web-based. They haven't done TV. They haven't done anything TVs. They haven't done billboards. They haven't done public advertising. I assume that's going to come when Stadia and the free version Stadia Base launches sometime in 2020. But so far, they're really just targeting that online audience.
Yeah. Well, that's Stadia. We'll see what happens when it launches next week, November 19th. We'll be covering it. We'll be playing it. And you can follow our coverage over at 95google.com. Before we round out the show, let's talk about one last thing, which is Phil Schiller's extremely fine take on Chromebooks. Yeah. For those that don't know, we'll cap off the show with this. The MacBook Pro 16-inch model launched this week. And I would bet that Apple PR is really, really mad at Phil Schiller for...
Their boss, for a couple
things that he's handled very poorly yesterday. One of which is actually relevant to the show. In case you're wondering if we're going to go completely off topic, don't turn us off yet. We're not switching to Apple as a topic. But Phil Schiller mentioned in an interview with CNET. Let's just read the quote. Let's get the fluffect here. He mentioned in an interview with CNET, they asked him basically about Chromebooks and how he feels about them. And here's the full quote. Kids who are really into learning and want to learn. So that's kind of redundant. Sorry, Phil, but really into learning and also want to learn will have better success with an iPad. Basically, it's not hard to understand why kids aren't engaged in a classroom without applying technology in a way that inspires them. You need to have these cutting edge learning tools to help kids really achieve their best results. And he went on to say, yet Chromebooks don't do that. Chromebooks have gotten to the classroom because, frankly, and he's claiming this is the one and only way in which Chromebooks have made their way into the public school classroom. They're cheap testing tools for required testing. This is also redundant. Testing tools for testing. If all you want to do is test kids, well, maybe a cheap notebook will do that. But they're, I think, referring to the kids, not going to succeed. So basically, Phil Schiller said, for kids who are into learning and want to learn, they need to use an iPad. And if they're using Chromebooks, which are cheap testing tools for testing, they're definitely not going to succeed as human beings in this life. that's the short version.
Okay. Phil, and, go on.
That's all I'm going to read.
Yeah.
Which is just, well, there's so much to unpack here. So much is just wrong. The first thing that's wrong is, testing is not the only reason that Chromebooks have been widely distributed in schools. First of all, testing is how the entire educational system works in America. So, sorry, Phil, but I mean, if you want to change that, you need to give every single school a $300 iPad for every single student or something. If you really want to create all these immersive experiences like you showed off when you announced the educational iPad or the iPad for education, you're not going to change the fact that testing is basically the foundation of our, unfortunately, the foundation of our educational system, and it determines whether kids go to college and which colleges kids go to and how much money they get to go to college. And it affects so much of the, I guess, secondary and post-secondary education in this country. And so I guess discounting them as simply testing tools is silly because schools do, in fact, need testing tools just because of the nature of the educational system. So there's that. Also, I think a really big point to be made is that when schools purchase these Chromebooks in bulk, they are very, very, very cheap. And Apple likes to charge exorbitant amounts for iPads, much less MacBooks. I think there were various takes on this. Some people thought he was alluding to MacBooks in this situation, comparing Chromebooks to MacBooks and saying schools really need the best tools possible if they're going to inspire kids, and referring to, I think one of the problems with this is that yesterday Apple launched one laptop and that laptop was $2,400. And I think a lot of people took this quote as basically Phil saying, hey, you should have MacBook Pros in your schools if you want to inspire children. I don't think that was the correct take. I think more he was alluding to the iPad, and I think that was the context of the interview if you actually read the full thing. But yeah, so I mean, Chromebooks are far cheaper than iPads. It's just the reality of it. They're far more durable. They have replaceable parts. And they have access to the entirety of the web, not to mention they're entitled to Google's entire classroom suite of software on the enterprise side of things, and also all of the productivity tools that Google offers. So yeah, it's stupid to say that Chromebooks have only been successful in schools because they're testing tools. What else has he done stupid here that I haven't, that I'm not thinking of? Or is that it?
Yeah, it's basically it. The one funny tip that I want to add is the web has won, and the idea that that Apple's iOS apps, if we're talking about the iPad, are going to be this revolutionary force to inspire children, that rich interactive experiences are going to truly inspire children in succeeding, is not reflective of how the actual world works, where the web has won, where everything's on the web, where the web is free, the web is accessible from any computer. If your iPad ever breaks, it's just Apple's often criticizes for painting this world of their ideal user, of this pro creative doing art on the iPad and video editing on the go, and now even coding on the iPad, which is a thing that's possible. And that Phil's comments were very much in that universe of this very ideal education experience that
It's the vision that they pitched when they launched the iPad for education at that event at that school. And it's a very idealistic, it really is.
If everybody can get there, it's great. Yeah, it's right. Utopian.
Right.
But that's not the reality.
If Apple wants that vision to become reality, it doesn't really do Apple or anyone any good to be condescending toward the current state of things, which is that Chromebooks have absolutely destroyed the iPad in adoption in schools. It's got to be insulting to anyone that leads technology teams in schools, because they're doing the best with the best they can with the resources they have. And Apple could be doing so much more with their billions of dollars in cash to actually make a difference in schools, rather than sell iPads at a premium that are not really great tools for the current state of things in the educational system. So, that's really my takeaway, is that Apple could be doing so much more, not to mention like on the software side, not to mention making iPads more accessible to schools in terms of pricing, and not to mention building better keyboard accessories so that kids can actually type papers on them, and building better productivity applications. And, you know, it's like Apple could be doing so much more, and it just seems really stupid to be just hurling poop at the competition on the day that you launch a $2,400 laptop. Mm-hmm. So anyways, that's kind of the story with Phil. and it's sad.
Unforced error.
Yes. Well, I think that pretty much rounds out the show. We've been on for about an hour now. I spared you the conversation of why I purchased a MacBook yesterday. And I will intend to keep it that way. And I expect lots of emails saying, thank you, Stephen, for not talking about Apple and not getting off topic. I would really appreciate those. So fill my inbox. Anyways, you can tune in to Alphabet Scoop here every week. We record this podcast on Thursdays lately, and you can find us on all your favorite podcasting platforms such as iTunes and Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, Google Play, and over at 95google.com. Thanks for tuning in as always. Thanks to Abner for joining me, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Later.